was dazzled to think that my friend could perform such a miracle with her mother's. I closed my eyes. The women sang like birds, only more sweetly. They sounded like the wind in the trees, but louder. Their voices were like the rush of the river's water, but with meaning. Then their words ceased, and they began to sing with sound that meant nothing at all, yet gave new voice to joy, to pleasure, to longing, to peace. Lu, 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 they sang. When they finished, Reuben applauded the music of our kinswomen and bowed low to them. Joseph and Judah and Dan also rose and bowed in thanks, and I thought, these four are my favorites and the best of my brothers. There were more songs and a few more stories, and we sat by the light of the lamps. Only when the moon began to set did the women clear the last of the cups. With sleeping children in their arms, the young mothers moved toward their own beds, and the men began taking their leave too. Finally, only Jacob and Esau sat, staring silently at the sputtering wick of the last lamp. Tobiah and I slipped away and walked down to the river, our arms around each other's waists. I was perfectly happy. I could have stood there until dawn, but my mother came to find me. And though she smiled at Tobiah, she took my hand and pulled me away from my friend. I woke the next morning to the sounds of Esau's tribe making ready to leave. During their late-night conversation, my father told his brother that he would not follow him back to Seir. As fondly as the brothers had met, their fortunes could not be married. My uncle's lands were vast and his position secure. Had we joined him, Jacob's worth would be judged puny in comparison. My brothers, too, would have been at a disadvantage, since Esau's sons already had flocks and lands of their own. And for all the fellowship of the night before, the sons of Isaac were not entirely reconciled, nor could they ever be. The scars they had borne for 20 years could not be erased with a single meeting, and the habits of those years, lived in such different worlds, were bound to come between them. Nevertheless, the brothers embraced with declarations of love and promises to visit. Reuben and Eliphaz clasped each other by the shoulder. The women nodded goodbye. Tobiah showed her boldness by running from her mother's side to hug me, and we tasted each other's tears. While we held each other, she whispered, "Take heart. We will be together again soon at the grandmother's tent. I heard my mother say we would surely meet you there at the barley festival. Remember everything that happens from now until then, so you can tell me." With that, she kissed me and ran back to her mother's side. She waved her hand until she was out of my sight. As soon as they departed, my father instructed Reuben and my mother to prepare for our own leave-taking. I did my part with a happy heart, glad to take up our travels free of the fear of Esau, eager to see my friend again and to meet the grandmother, who had already begun to live in my imagination. I was certain that Rebecca would love my mothers. After all, they were her nieces as well as her daughters-in-law, and I imagined myself her pet, her favorite. Why shouldn't I be, I thought. After all, I was the female heir of her favored son. The next morning we departed, but we did not travel far. On the second day, my father plunged his staff into the earth near a small stream beneath a young oak tree and announced his intention to stay. We were near a village called Sukkot, he said, a place that had been kind to him on his journey north. My brothers had scouted the land before and secured a site for us, and within a few days there were pens and stalls for the animals and a fine clay oven, large enough to bake both bread and cakes. We dwelt there for 2 years. The journey from the house of Laban had given me a taste for change, and the daily routines of settled life in Sukkot bored me at first. But my days were filled from sunrise to dusk, and soon I learned to enjoy the alchemy of turning flour into bread, meat into stew, water into beer. I also moved from spinning to weaving, which was far more difficult than I had ever imagined, and a skill I never mastered like Zilpa and Bilha, for whom the warp never broke. As the oldest girl, I was often given charge of the bondswomen's children, and learned both to love and resent the runny-nosed monsters. I was needed so much within the world of women that I barely noticed how little I had to do with my brothers, or how things changed among them. For those were the days when Levi and Simon replaced Reuben at my father's right hand and became his closest advisers. Sukkot was a fertile place for my family. Zebatu had a new baby, and so did Uznah, both of them sons, whom my father took to his altar under the oak tree. He circumcised them and declared them free of their father's indenture, full members of the tribe of El Abram, and the tribe of Jacob grew. Bilha conceived in Sukkot, but she miscarried before the baby moved in her womb. Rachel was bereaved in this manner as well, and for nearly a month after would not let Joseph out of her sight. My mother, too, lost a child, who came from the womb months too soon. The women looked away from the tiny doomed girl, but I saw only her perfect beauty. Her eyelids were veined like a butterfly's wing, her toes curled like the petals of a flower. I held my sister, who was never given a name, and who never opened her eyes, and who died in my arms. I was not afraid to hold that small death. Her face was peaceful, her hands perfectly clean. It seemed she would wake at any moment. The tears from my eyes fell upon her alabaster cheek, and it appeared that she mourned the passing of her own life. My mother came to take my sister from me, but seeing my sorrow, permitted me to carry her to burial. She was shrouded in a scrap of fine cloth and laid beneath the strongest, oldest tree within sight of my mother's tent. No offerings were made, but as the bundle was covered with earth, the sighs that poured from my mother's mouths were as eloquent as any psalm. As we walked away from the baby's death, Zilpa muttered that the gods of the place were arrayed against life, but as usual, my auntie misread the signs. For the bondswomen grew great with child as quickly as their babies were weaned. Every ewe and goat bore twins, and all of them survived. The flocks grew quickly and made my father a prosperous man, which meant my brothers could wed. Three of them married in Sukkot. Judah married Shua, the daughter of a trader. She conceived during their nuptial week and bore him Er, the first of his sons and the first of my father's grandsons. I liked Shua, who was plump and good-natured. She brought the Canaanite gift of song into our tents and taught us harmonies. Simon and Levi took two sisters to wife, Ialutu and Inbu, daughters of a potter. It fell to me to stay with the babies and mind the fires while the wives of Jacob attended the festivities. I was furious about being left behind, but in the weeks after the nuptials, I heard my mother's talk over every detail of the wedding so much that I felt I had been there myself. "Surely you must admit the singing was wonderful," said Zilpa, who returned from each one humming a new melody, slapping the rhythm with her hand against a bony thigh. "Well, of course," said my mother in an offhand way. "They learn this from their mothers and grandmothers." Rachel grinned and leaned over to Leah. "Too bad their grandmothers could not cook, eh?" Leah smirked in agreement. "When it is Dina's turn to enter the bridal tent, I will show them all how a wedding feast should be arrayed," she said, running her hand over my head. Only Bilha seemed to enjoy her nephew's weddings. "Oh, sister," she said to Leah, "didn't you think the veil was pretty, shot through with golden threads and hung with the dowry coins? I thought she was arrayed like a goddess." Leah would have none of it. "Are you going to tell me that your belly was full after the meal?" she said. But Leah was not unhappy in the brides her sons brought her. They were all healthy and respectful, though Shua quickly became the favorite. The two sisters never fully entered my mother's circle, and they lived with their husbands at a short distance from the rest of us, closer to the herds, my brother said. I think Simon and Levi moved because Ialutu and Inbu wanted to keep their distance. I did not miss their company at all. They treated me with the same disdain as their husbands. And besides, my mother was right. Neither of them could cook. Of Jacob's older sons, only Reuben remained unmarried. My eldest brother seemed content to serve his mother and to do kindness to Bilhah, whose only son was still too young to hunt. Early one morning, while everyone slept, a woman's voice called, "Where are the daughters of Sarai? Where are the wives of Jacob?" It was a soft voice, and yet it woke me from a deep sleep where I lay at my mother's feet. Like me, Leah sat up at the sound and hurried outside, arriving at the same moment as Rachel. Within a heartbeat, Bilhah and Zilpah were there as well. The five of us staring at the messenger from Mamre, whose dress shimmered silver in the blue glow that heralds the dawn. Her speech was formal, in the manner of all messengers. "Rebecca, the oracle at Mamre, the mother of Jacob and Esau, the grandmother of hundreds of myriads, calls you to the canopy of terebinths for the barley festival. Let Jacob be told and know." Silence greeted the declaration of this visitor, who spoke in strange accents that bent every word in three places. It was as though we were all sharing a dream, for none of us had ever seen red hair before, nor had we ever seen a woman carry the messenger-striped bag. And yet, it was no dream, as the morning chill made us shiver. Finally, Leah caught her breath and gave welcome, offering the stranger a place to sit and bread to eat. But as soon as we were assembled around our guest, my aunties and I again fell still and stared in plain amazement. The messenger looked around her and broke into a smile that showed a row of small yellow teeth between a pair of oddly dappled lips. Speaking now in an ordinary voice, and with a lightness that set everyone at ease, she said, "I see you number few redheads among you. Where I come from, it is said that redheaded women are begotten during their mother's periods. Such is the ignorance of the lands to the north." Bilhah laughed out loud to hear such boldness from a stranger. This seemed to please our guest, who turned to my aunt and presented herself. "My name is Werenro, and I serve the grandmother." At that, she pulled her hair back to show her ear, pierced high with the plain bronze stud, and added, "I am the world's happiest slave." Again, Bilhah laughed aloud at such plain-spokenness. I giggled, too. As soon as the men were fed, Leah sent for Jacob and presented the messenger, who by then had covered the fire of her hair and lowered her eyes. "She comes from your mother," Leah said. "Rebecca bids us attend her barley festival. The messenger awaits your reply." Jacob seemed startled by the newcomer's presence, but composed himself quickly and told Leah that they would obey Rebecca in everything, and that he would come to her at harvest time, he and his wives, with his sons and his daughters. Werenro then withdrew to my mother's tent and slept. I worked nearby all day, hoping to catch a glimpse of her. I tried to think of some reason to enter the tent. I wanted to see that hair again, and my fingers longed to touch the robes that moved like weeds in flowing water. Inna told me that Werenro's clothes were made of silk, a kind of cloth that was woven by worms on their own tiny looms. I raised my eyebrow, doing my best to copy my mother's most disdainful gesture, to show that I was too old to be taken in by such nonsense. Inna laughed at me, and wasted no further breath on my disbelief. Werenro rested undisturbed late into the evening, until after the men had eaten and the bowls of the women's evening meal were cleared. My mothers had gathered by their fire, hoping the stranger would appear in time to give us a story. The messenger walked out of the tent, and seeing us arrayed around her, she bowed deeply, with her fingers stretched wide, in an unfamiliar gesture of obeisance. Then she straightened her back, looked into our faces one by one, and grinned like a little child who has stolen a fig. Warrenroe was unlike anyone or anything else in the world. I was enchanted. She bowed her head at my mother's in thanks for the bowl of olives, cheese, and fresh bread that had been left for her. Before eating, she recited a short prayer in a language that sounded like a buzzard's cry. I laughed at the noise, thinking she was making another joke, but the red-headed stranger shot me a look of withering anger. I felt as though my face had been slapped, and my cheeks grew hot and as crimson as her hair, which was once again visible and as improbably red as I remembered. But in the next moment, she smiled forgiveness at me, and patting the ground by her side, welcomed me to a place of honor. After she put aside the last of her meal, with compliments for the bread and extravagant praise for the beer, Warrenroe began a chant. There were many strange names in her story, and a melody that was sadder than anything I'd ever heard. She held us all wrapped like a baby on a lap. It was a story of the beginning of the world, of Tree and Hawk, who gave birth to Red Wolf, who populated the world with a womb that gave birth to all red-blooded life, save woman and man. It was a very long story, mysterious and filled with names of unfamiliar trees and animals. It was set in a place of terrible cold, where the wind screamed in pain. It was frightening and thrilling and lonely. When Warrenroe stopped, the fire was out, and only one lamp sputtered a dim light. The little ones were asleep in their mother's laps, and even a few of the women dozed, their heads dropping on their chests. I looked into the face of the messenger, but she did not see me. Her eyes were closed above smiling lips. She was far away in the land of her story, a cold land of strange myths, where her own mother was buried. I felt the messenger's loneliness, so far from home. I understood Warrenroe's heart the way I understood the sun when it warmed my face. I reached out my hand and placed it on her shoulder, and Warrenroe turned to me, opened eyes that glistened with tears, and kissed me on the lips. "Thank you," she said, and stood. She walked into my mother's tent and left before dawn without telling me how the Red Wolf in her story gave rise to man and woman. But this did not worry me, for I knew that I would hear the rest of it at Mamre, when we went to see the grandmother at last. Chapter 5. Preparations for the journey began a month before the barley harvest. My father decided that he would bring all of his wives to Mamre and most of his sons. Simon and Levi were told to remain behind with the flocks, and since both of their wives were pregnant for the first time, they did not object. Although Shua was not with child, Judah asked to be left back as well, and the women all knew why. The whooping sounds of their nightly pleasure were a source of jokes and smirking. My brothers and I were summoned to our mothers, who examined our best clothes and found them wanting. A flurry of washing, mending, and sewing followed. Rachel decided to make a new tunic for her only son. Joseph's robe, decorated with bands of red and yellow, earned him some awful teasing from his brothers. He ignored their taunts and swore he preferred the garment his mother had made for him over the dull stuff that men were given to wear. I couldn't tell if he was putting on a brave front or really liked his finery. I was given bracelets for my wrists, my first jewelry. They were only copper, but I loved them, especially the womanly sound they made. Indeed, I spent so much time admiring the way the three bands gathered on my wrists that I paid no attention to my feet, and on the first day I wore them, tripped and scraped my chin raw. I was horrified at the thought that I would meet the grandmother looking like a scabby child. Every day until we left, I studied my face in Rachel's mirror, begged Inna for salve, and picked at the enormous red crust. The day we left for Mamre, I was beside myself with excitement and ignored every request made of me. My mother, who was everywhere at once, making sure that the oil and wine jars were securely sealed, that the brothers had combed their beards, that everything was ready, finally lost patience with me. It was one of the few times she ever raised her voice to me. "Either you help me, or I will leave you behind to wait upon your brothers' wives," she said. She didn't have to say another word. The journey took only a few days, and it was a joyful trip. We sang as we walked, preening in our finery and proud of our beautiful flock, for only the best of the animals had been culled for gifts to the grandmother. Jacob walked beside Rachel early in the morning, inhaling her perfume, smiling, saying little. Then he took his place beside Leah to discuss the animals, the crops, and the proper etiquette for greeting his parents. Late in the afternoon, Jacob found his way to Bilhah, displacing Reuben, her shadow. My father walked with his hand upon her little shoulder, as though he needed her support. I was perfectly happy. Joseph stayed beside me, and even forgot himself enough to hold my hand from time to time. At night, I settled in beside Zilpah, who fed my awe of the grandmother with tales about Rebecca's reputation as a diviner, healer, and prophet, so that I could barely fall asleep. I could barely keep myself from running, for I was going to see Tabia again. Werenroe would smile at me and tell more of her story, and I would meet the grandmother, who I imagined would understand me instantly and adore me above any of my brothers. Mid-morning on the third day, we caught sight of Rebecca's tent. Even from a distance, it was a marvel, though at first I didn't really understand what shimmered on the far side of the valley before me. It was enormous, far bigger than any tent I had ever seen, and utterly unlike our dull goat-hair dwellings. This was an earth-bound rainbow, red, yellow, and blue, billowing upon the high ground under a stand of great old trees, whose branches implored a cloudless heaven. As we came closer, it became clear that this was less a home than a canopy, open on all sides to welcome travelers from every direction. Inside, we caught glimpses of vivid hangings in patterns that were both delicate and bold, with scenes of dancing women and flying fish, stars, crescents, suns, birds. It was more beautiful than any handmade thing I had seen. When we could almost feel the shade of the sacred grove, the grandmother came into view. She did not come out to meet us, nor did she send any of her women out, but waited in the shade of the wonderful tent, arms crossed, watching. I could not take my eyes off her. I do not remember my father's formal greeting, or the ceremony to present my brothers one by one, and then the gifts, and finally my mother's and me. I saw only her, the grandmother, my grandmother. She was the oldest person I had ever seen. Her years proclaimed themselves in the deep furrows on her brow and around her mouth, but the beauty of youth still clung to her. She stood as erect as Reuben and nearly as tall. Her black eyes were clear and sharp, painted in the Egyptian style, a pattern of heavy black coal that made her appear all-seeing. Her robes were purple, the color of royalty and holiness and wealth. Her head covering was long and black, shot through with gold threads, providing the illusion of luxurious hair, where in fact only a few gray strands were left to her. Rebecca did not notice while I stared. The eyes of the grandmother were fixed upon the son she had not seen since he was a smooth-cheeked boy, now a man with grown sons and a grandfather. She showed no emotion as Jacob presented his children, his wives, and the gifts he had brought. She nodded, accepting everything, saying nothing. I thought she was magnificent, aloof as a queen. But I saw my mother's mouth purse in displeasure. She had anticipated a show of maternal love for the favored son. I could not see my father's face to measure his reaction. After the official welcome, the grandmother turned away from us, and we were taken to the west side of the hill to set up our tents and prepare for the evening meal. That's where I learned that Tabia had not yet arrived, and that Werenro had been sent to Tyre to trade for the rare purple dye that the grandmother favored. No men lived at the grove. Rebecca was attended by 10 women, who also saw to the pilgrims who came seeking advice and prophecy from her they called Oracle. When I asked about my father's father, one of the grandmother's attendants told me that Isaac dwelt a short distance away, in the village of Arba, in a snug hut that was kinder than an open tent to his old bones. "He will come for the meal tonight," said the woman, whose only name was Deborah. The grandmother called all of her acolytes Deborah, in honor of the woman who had been her childhood nurse and lifelong retainer, and whose bones lay buried beneath the trees of Mamre. The grandmother's women spoke in shy whispers and dressed in the same plain white tunic. They were uniformly kind but distant, and I quickly stopped trying to see them as individuals and began to think of them all as the Deborahs. The afternoon passed quickly in preparation for the evening meal. Just as the first bread was coming off the fire, word came that Isaac had arrived. I raced around to watch as my grandfather approached the grove. Rebecca came to watch too, and she raised her hand in a brief greeting. My father walked out to greet him, his step growing faster and faster, until he was actually running toward his father. Isaac did not respond to his wife's salute or his son's excitement. He continued, seemingly serene, in his cushioned seat upon a donkey being led by a woman wearing the white robes of my grandmother's entourage, though this one wore a veil that covered everything but her eyes. It was only when he came close that I saw that my grandfather was blind. His eyes closed in a tight squint that soured the whole of his face into a permanent scowl. He was small-boned and thin, and would have seemed frail, except that his hair was as thick and dark as a younger man's. The grandmother watched as the serving woman helped Isaac descend and walked him to his blanket on the east side of Mamre. But before the servant released his elbow, Isaac took her hand in his and brought it to his lips. He kissed her palm and placed it upon his cheek. Isaac's face relaxed into a smile, so that anyone who cared to see would know that the Veiled One was the companion of my grandfather's heart. My father stood before Isaac and said, "Father," in a voice overflowing with tears. Isaac turned his face toward Jacob and opened his arms. My father embraced the old man, and both of them wept. They spoke in whispers as my brothers stood and waited to be introduced. My mothers held back, exchanging glances of concern over the food, which would be dry and tasteless if it wasn't served soon. But the men would not be rushed. Isaac pulled his son to a seat by his side as Jacob introduced each of his sons. Isaac ran his hands over the faces of my brothers Reuben and Zebulun, Dan, Gad, and Asher, Naphtali and Issachar. When Joseph was finally named as the youngest son, the grandfather pulled him down into his lap as though he were a baby and not a boy nearing manhood. Isaac tenderly ran his fingers over the contours of Joseph's face and over the sinews of his arms. A breeze rose up and lifted the silken tent high above them, embracing the grandfather and his grandson in its wonderful rainbow. It was a grand sight, and it took my breath away. And that is precisely when Rebecca, who had kept her distance until then, finally broke her majestic silence. "You must be hungry and thirsty, Isaac," she said, offering hospitality in an ungracious voice. "Your children are parched from their journey. Let your Deborah bring you inside. Let your daughters-in-law show me whether they can cook. A flurry of white garments laid out the meal, and the feast began. My grandfather ate well, taking his mouthfuls from the fingers of the veiled woman. He asked whether his grandsons had eaten enough, and reached out from time to time to find his son, placing a doting hand on his shoulder or his cheek, leaving smears of oil that my father did not wipe away. I watched this from behind a tree, for with all those servants there was no need of my carrying food or drink. My brothers were hungry and finished quickly, and soon Zilpah fetched me back to our side of the great tent where the women were gathered. The grandmother sat down, and we watched as she had a single taste of everything before her. She said nothing about the stews, or the breads, or the sweets. She did not praise the cheese, or the giant olives my mother's had collected. She did not acknowledge my mother's beer. But already I was not surprised by Rebecca's silence. I had stopped thinking of her as a woman like my mother's, or like any other woman, for that matter. In the space of an afternoon, she had become a force of the gods, like a rainstorm or a brush fire. Because the grandmother ate little and said nothing, our meal was more somber than festive. There was no passing of bowls for a second taste, no compliments, no questions, no conversation at all. The great feast was done in a few minutes, and the Deborahs cleared the last cups before there was time to think of refilling them. The grandmother rose to her feet and walked to the western edge of her tent, where the sun was setting in a blaze of orange and gold. Her attendants followed. Rebecca reached her hands to the sun, as if to touch its last rays. When she dropped her hands, the attendants began singing a song inviting the barley harvest moon. The verses repeated an ancient prophecy. When every stalk of every barley field numbered 27 seeds, the end of days would arrive, and there would be rest for the weary, and evil would vanish from the earth like starlight at sunrise. The last chorus ended just as darkness swallowed the camp. Lamps were lit among the men, and lamps were lit among the women. The grandmother came with us, and I feared we would sit in silent attendance for the whole of the evening. But my fear was ungrounded, for as soon as the lights were kindled, she began to speak. This is the story of the day I came to the tent of Mamre, to the grove of sacred trees, to the navel of the world, said the grandmother, Rebecca, in tones that could have been heard by the men had they been listening. It was in the weeks after the death of Sarai the prophet, beloved of Abram, mother of Isaac. She who gave birth when she was too old to carry water, much less carry a child. Sarai, cherished mother. On the morning I entered this grove, a cloud descended over the tent of Sarai, a golden cloud that bore no rain, nor did it cover the sun. It was a cloud that is seen only upon great rivers and upon the sea, but never before in a place so high. And yet, the cloud hovered above the tent of Sarai, while Isaac knew me, and I became his wife. We spent our first 7 days as husband and wife under that cloud, in which the gods were surely present. And there was never a harvest richer in wine and grain and oil than that spring, my daughters, she said in a whisper that was at once proud and defeated. Ah, but for me, so many daughters born dead, so many sons dead in the womb, only two survive. Who can explain this mystery? The grandmother fell silent, and her dark mood covered her listeners, and our shoulders sagged. Even I, who had lost no children, felt a mother's bereavement. After a moment, my grandmother rose and pointed to Leah, that she should follow her into an inner chamber of the great tent, where the lamps were lit with scented oil and the tapestries glowed. The rest of us sat for a while before we realized that we had been dismissed. My mother's interview with the grandmother went on late into the night, First, Rebecca took a long look at her daughter-in-law, betraying her short-sightedness by getting very close and peering into her face. Then she began the close interrogation into every detail of Leah's life. "Why did they not put you out to die at birth with eyes such as yours? What is your mother's burial place? How do you prepare wool for dyeing? Where did you learn to make that beer? What kind of father is Jacob, my son? Which of your sons is your favorite? Which of your sons do you fear? How many lambs does my son sacrifice to El at the spring festival? What is your practice at the new moon? How many babies have you lost in childbearing? What plans do you make for your daughter's coming of age? How many ephahs of barley do you grow in Sukkot, and how many of wheat?" My mother could not even remember all of the questions put to her that night, but she answered them fully and without taking her eyes from the grandmother's face. This startled the older woman, who was used to unnerving people, but Leah was not cowed. The two of them glared at each other. Finally, when the grandmother could think of nothing else to ask, she nodded and made a wordless sound, a grunt of grudging approval. "Very well, Leah, mother of many sons, very well." With a wave of her hand, my mother was sent away. She found her way to her blanket and fell asleep, exhausted. Over the next 2 days, my aunties were called to the grandmother's inner chamber, one by one. Rachel was greeted with kisses and caresses. Girlish laughter rang out as the two of them passed an afternoon together. The grandmother patted my lovely aunt's cheeks and gently pinched her arms. Rebecca, who had been the beauty of her generation, took out her makeup box, a large black lacquered thing with many compartments, each one filled with a potion or unguent, perfume or paint. Rachel left the grandmother's presence smiling and smelling of lotus oil, her eyelids green, and her eyes ringed with a shiny black coal that made her look formidable instead of merely beautiful. When Zilpah was sent for, my auntie fell upon her face before the grandmother and was rewarded with a short poem about the great Asherah, consort of El and goddess of the sea. The grandmother looked briefly into Zilpah's face, closed her black eyes, and foretold the time and place of my auntie's death. This news, which she never revealed to a soul, did not disturb Zilpah. If anything, it gave her a kind of peace that lasted the rest of her life. From that day forward, Zilpah smiled while she worked at the loom, not a wistful little grin at all, but a big, tooth-showing smile, as though she were remembering a good joke. Bilhah dreaded her interview with the grandmother and stumbled as she approached the old woman. The grandmother frowned and sighed while Bilhah kept her eyes on her hands. The silence grew heavy, and after a short time, Rebecca turned and walked out, leaving Bilhah alone with the beautiful tapestries that seemed to mock her. These meetings meant little to me. For 3 days, my eyes were on the horizon, watching for Tabia. She finally arrived on the day of the festival itself, with Esau and his first wife, Adat. The sight of my best friend was more than I could stand, and I ran to her. She threw her arms around me. When we stood apart, I saw how much she had changed in the few months we had spent apart. She was taller than I by a good half head, and there was no need to pull her garments tightly against her chest to see her breasts. But when I saw the belt that declared her a woman, my mouth dropped. She had entered the red tent. She was no longer a child, but a woman. I felt my cheeks grow warm with envy, as hers grew pink with pride. I had 1,000 questions to ask her about what it was like, and about her ceremony, and whether the world was a different place now that her place in it was different. But I had no time to ask my cousin anything. The grandmother had already taken note of Tabia's apron and approached my coin-covered aunt. Within a few moments, she was screaming at Adat with a fury I thought reserved for gods who had thunder and lightning at their disposal. Rebecca's anger was terrible. You mean to tell me that her blood was wasted? You shut her up alone, like some animal? Adat cringed and made as if to answer when the grandmother raised her fists. Don't dare to defend yourself, you ignorant nothing, she hissed. You baboon! I told you what to do, and you disobeyed me. And now there is nothing to be done. The best of his girls, the only one of his seed with even a trace of intelligence or feeling, and you treated her like a... Bah! Rebecca spit at her daughter-in-law's feet. I have no words for this abomination. Her voice grew icy and hushed. Enough. You are not fit to be in my tent. Get out of here. Be cursed, and leave this place and never let me see you again. The grandmother drew herself up to her full height and slapped Adat with all her strength. The poor woman crumpled to the ground, whimpering in fear that a spell had been cast on her. The men, who had rushed over to discover the reason for the grandmother's displeasure, recoiled at the sight of the oracle's curse and quickly turned away from what was clearly women's business. Adat crawled away, but now Tabia was on the ground at Rebecca's feet, sobbing, No, no, no! My cousin's face had turned ashen, and her eyes were wide with terror. Take my name and call me Deborah, too. Make me the least of your servants, but do not banish me. Oh, please, grandmother, please! I beg you! I beg you! But Rebecca did not look at the creature suffering at her feet. She did not see Tabia tear at her face until there were bloody streaks down her cheeks. She did not see her rip her robe into shreds or swallow handfuls of dust. The grandmother turned and walked away from the death throes of Tabia's hope, wrapping her cloak tightly around her body, as if to protect herself against the misery before her. Finally, Tabia was lifted from the ground by the grandmother's followers and carried back to the tents of Esau's wives. I did not really understand what had happened, but I knew that my dear friend had suffered an injustice. My ears rang and my heart pounded. I could not believe the grandmother's cruelty. My beloved cousin, who cared more for Rebecca than for her own mother, had been treated worse than the lepers who came seeking miracle cures. I hated Rebecca as I had never hated anyone. My mother took my hand, led me to her tent, and gave me a cup of sweet wine. Stroking my hair, she answered my question even before I asked. Leah, my mother said, the girl will suffer for the rest of her days, and your compassion is well placed. But your hatred is undeserved, daughter. It was not her intention to harm Tabia. I think she loved her well enough, but she had no choice. She was defending her mother and herself, me and your aunties, you and your daughters after you. She was defending the ways of our mothers and their mothers and the Great Mother, who goes by many names, but who is in danger of being forgotten. This is not easy to explain, but I will tell you. Because you are my only daughter, and because we lived for so long in such isolation, you already know much more than you should. You have spent time with us in the Red Tent. You have even attended a birth, which is something you must never tell the grandmother. I know that you will not reveal what I tell you now. I nodded my promise, and my mother sighed from her heart. She looked down at her hands, brown from the sun, wise with use, and rarely in repose as they were now. She placed her palms face up upon her knees and closed her eyes. Half singing, half whispering, Leia said, The Great Mother whom we call Inanna is a fierce warrior and death's bridesmaid. The Great Mother whom we call Inanna is the center of pleasure, the one who makes women and men turn to one another in the night. The Great Mother whom we call Inanna is the queen of the ocean and the patron of the rain. This is known to all, to the women and to the men, to the suckling babes and to the failing grandfathers. Here she stopped and broke into a big girlish grin. Zilpah would be so amused at the sight of me speaking legend, she said, looking straight at me for a moment, and I smiled back at her, sharing the joke. But after a moment, my mother resumed her formal pose and continued. The great mother, whom we call Inanna, gave a gift to woman that is not known among men, and this is the secret of blood. The flow at the dark of the moon, the healing blood of the moon's birth. To men, this is flux and distemper, bother and pain. They imagine we suffer and consider themselves lucky. We do not disabuse them. In the red tent, the truth is known. In the red tent, where days pass like a gentle stream, as the gift of Inanna courses through us, cleansing the body of last month's death, preparing the body to receive the new month's life, women give thanks for repose and restoration, for the knowledge that life comes from between our legs and that life costs blood. Then she took my hand and told me, I say this before the proper time, daughter mine, though it will not be long before you enter the tent to celebrate with me and your aunties. You will become a woman, surrounded by loving hands to carry you and to catch your first blood, and to make sure it goes back to the womb of Inanna, to the dust that formed the first man and the first woman, the dust that was mixed with her moon blood. Alas, many of her daughters have forgotten the secret of Inanna's gift and turned their backs on the red tent. Esau's wives, the daughters of Edom, whom Rebekah despises, give no lesson or welcome to their young women when they come of age. They treat them like beasts, setting them out alone and afraid, shut up in the dark days of the new moon, without wine and without the counsel of their mothers. They do not celebrate the first blood of those who will bear life, nor do they return it to the earth. They have set aside the opening, which is the sacred business of women, and permit men to display their daughters' bloody sheets, as though even the pettiest Baal would require such a degradation in tribute. My mother saw my confusion. You cannot understand all of this yet, Dina, she said. But soon you will know, and I will make sure that you are welcomed into the woman's life with ceremony and tenderness. Fear not. It was dark when my mother uttered the last of these words. The songs of the barley festival reached our ears, and my mother rose, offering me her hand. We walked out into the night to watch the offerings burnt on an altar beside the tallest tree. Wonderful music was sung, harmonies of many parts. The Deborahs danced in a circle to the sound of their own clapping. They spun and crouched, leaped and swayed, as though sharing a single mind, a single body, and I understood Tabia's wish to join their dance. Adat disappeared during the night, taking my friend with her, strapped onto the back of a donkey like an offering not yet dead, with a rag stuffed in her mouth to muffle the cries. In the few days before our departure, I avoided the grandmother and stayed near my mother's. I wished only to leave the place, but as we prepared to return to Sukkot, Leah came to me with a grim face. The grandmother says that you are to stay here at Mamre for 3 months, she said. Rebecca spoke to your father, and it has been arranged without my... She stopped at the sight of my stricken face. I wish I could stay or leave Zilpah with you, but the grandmother will have none of it. She wants you only. There was a long pause before she said, It is an honor. She cupped my chin between her two hands and added tenderly, We will be together again when the wheat is ripe. I did not cry. I was frightened and angry, but I was determined not to weep, so I kept my mouth closed, breathed through my nose, and kept my eyes from blinking. That was how I survived, as I watched my mother's form grow smaller and smaller, and then disappear into the horizon. I had never imagined the loneliness of being without her, or my aunts, or even one of my brothers. I felt like a baby left outside to die, but I did not cry. I turned back to the Deborahs, who watched me anxiously, but I did not cry. Only at night, alone on my blanket, I turned my face to the ground and wept until I choked. Every morning I arose, groggy and confused, until I remembered that I was alone in my grandmother's tent. My memories from those months in Mamre seem pale and scattered. When I returned to my mother's, they were disappointed that I could not say more of wonders I had seen or secrets I had learned. It was as though I had walked through a cave filled with jewels and picked up only a handful of gray pebbles. This is what I do remember. I recall that once in every 7 days, the grandmother made a great show of baking. The rest of the week she did not soil her hands with the work of women, much less the kneading and handling of dough. But on the 7th day, she took flour and water and honey, turned them and shaped them, and sacrificed a corner from a 3-sided cake. "For the Queen of Heaven," she whispered to the dough before consigning it to flame. I doubted that the queen would much care for the dry, tasteless things Rebecca offered. "Aren't they good?" she demanded when they came out of the oven. I nodded dutifully, washing my portion down with water, which was all I was given to drink. Luckily, her servants were far better bakers, and their cakes were sweet and moist enough for any queen. Still, when my grandmother whispered over her small domestic offering, it was the only time I saw her smile with her eyes. It was my job to go to Rebecca early in the morning to assist her morning ablutions in preparation for the pilgrims who arrived at the grove daily. I carried her elaborate cosmetic box, which contained different scents for forehead, wrists, armpits, and ankles, a potion for the skin beneath the eyes, and a sour-smelling concoction for the throat. After the perfumes and creams, she began the careful application of color to lips, eyes, and cheeks. She said that the most important beauty treatment of all was to smell sweet, and her breath was always scented with mint, which she chewed morning and night. The grandmother seemed to burn with some kind of fire. She ate little and rarely sat down. She looked down upon anyone who required rest. Indeed, she criticized everyone except her sons, and although she favored Jacob, praising his good looks and his fine sons, it was clear that she depended on my uncle for everything. Messengers came and went from Seir every other day. Esau was called upon to deliver an extra ephah of barley, or to find meat worthy of the grandmother's table. I saw him every fortnight at least, his arms full of gifts. My uncle was a good man and a fine son. He made sure that wealthy pilgrims visited the grove and brought rich offerings. He found Isaac the stone hut that afforded Rebecca the luxury of living like a priestess without a man to serve. The grandmother patted Esau's cheek whenever he left her tent, and he would glow as though she had praised him to heaven, which she never did. My grandmother never spoke ill of Esau, nor did she say anything good about him. His wives, however, she detested in detail. Although they were dutiful women who, at one time, sent fine gifts in hopes of winning her approval, she dismissed them all as slovenly idiots. For years she had sneered at them openly, so they visited only when Esau insisted. She was not much kinder about my mother's. She considered Rachel lazy, beautiful, but lazy. She called Bilhah ugly, and Zilpah a superstitious stick. She grudgingly admitted that Leah was a good worker, and clearly blessed, to have delivered so many healthy sons. But even Leah was not good enough for Jacob, who deserved a perfect mate, not a giantess with mismatched eyes. She actually said such things in my presence, as though I were not my mother's daughter, as if my aunts were not my beloved mothers, too. But I did not defend them. When the oracle spoke, no contradictions were permitted. I was not as bold as Leia, and my nighttime tears often tasted of shame as well as loneliness. Rebecca saved the worst of her tongue for her husband, though. Isaac had grown foolish with old age, she said, and he smelled, something she could not abide. He had forgotten what he owed her, for hadn't she been right to make him give the blessing to Jacob? She spoke incessantly about Isaac's ingratitude and her suffering at his hands, but it was not clear to me what my grandfather had done. He seemed gentle and harmless when he came on hot days, to enjoy the breezes beneath the great terebinths. I was glad that Isaac had no need of Rebecca's care. He was well served by his veiled Deborah. It was rumored that her covering hid a hare lip, though it was unthinkable that such a one would not have been killed in infancy. When Esau came to Mamre, he visited his mother first and saw to her needs. He was polite and even fond, but as soon as he could, he turned to the grandfather and accompanied him back to Arba, where the two men enjoyed their evening wine. They stayed up very late, talking and laughing, served by the veiled Deborah. I learned this from the other ones who wore white. They were kind to me. They patted my shoulder when they gave me my dinner, brushed my hair, and let me work with their beautiful ivory spindles. But they did not tell stories in the evenings, and I never learned the names their own mothers had given them, or how they had come to Mamre, or if they missed the company of men. They seemed mild and content, but as colorless as their robes. I did not envy them their life with the oracle. At the new moon, Rebecca did not permit me to enter the red tent with the women who bled. She was strict about this observance. She who was past childbearing did not enter, nor could I, who was still unripe. One of the other Deborahs stayed outside with us as well. She explained that her periods had never come, but did not complain about her lack of rest. She and I cooked and served the celebrants, whose quiet laughter made me long for my mother's tent. When the women emerged, rested and smiling, on the morning after the third day, I was permitted to follow them as they stood at the highest point of the hill to watch the sun rise. The grandmother herself poured out a libation of wine, while the women sang a wordless song of quiet rejoicing. In the deep silence that followed, it seemed to me that the Queen of Heaven was in the trees above us. That memory returns to me at every new moon. I never learned to love my grandmother. I could not forget or forgive what she had done to Tabia. Nevertheless, the day came when I honored her. The doors to the oracle's tent were always open, and from every direction the stranger was made welcome. This had been the decree of Sarai and Abram, who, it was said, gave an equal welcome to princes and beggars. And so, every morning, Rebecca would receive pilgrims inside the beautiful tent. She saw all who came, wretched or resplendent, nor did she hurry with the poor. I stood with her women as she greeted the guests. First, a childless woman approached and begged for a son. The oracle gave her a red cord to tie around one of the trees at Mamre, whispered a blessing in the barren one's ear, and bid her go with the Deborah skilled in herbs. Next, there was a trader seeking a charm for his caravan. "It has been a bad season for me," he began. "I am nearly destitute, but I have heard of your powers," he said, with a bit of a dare creeping into his voice. "I've come to see for myself." The grandmother moved close to him and looked into his face until he turned away from her gaze.